abstract intellectual powers, certainly dip deeply into Neoplatonism and into Gnosticism. And as a result of this, the church itself gradually passed into a schismatic state in which the heresies began to appear. These heresies resulting very largely from the intellectual individuality of leaders, which continued to beset the faith even after these other organizations no longer presented a challenge. Actually, therefore, we must recognize that these three great systems and several others, to lesser degree, have influenced the rise of Christianity. They have influenced its doctrines. And as we have said, the uniting of the Christian front against these non-Christian movements hastened the rise of hierarchical Christianity. That is, the rise of a strong central church government, capable of clearly stating its own convictions. And this, in turn, called up the councils, the various gatherings, the synods, and the assemblies in which the great ecclesiastical principles were variously debated until gradually the Christianity that we know took form and appeared. Now, if we have these patterns a little bit familiar to us, we can see essentially that even in our own thinking, as in those days, the individual is not united. Synesius of Alexandria was a Christian bishop, a Neoplatonist, a Gnostic, and a Hermetist at the same time, and found no difficulty, no conflict, no contradiction, and no heresy, simply because he had not the kind of intellectual capacity that pigeonholed various concepts within his own nature. He was perhaps more able to build a magnificent faith upon the total reconciliation of the inconsistencies between these doctrines. He was also able, by the grace of God, to retain his orthodox standing in spite of all of these modifying circumstances. He therefore represents, in a sense, the synthesis of these beliefs, and to our thinking today, a rather outstanding example of the possibility of religious reconciliation. Now, reconciliation in our time does involve very strongly the problem of these three schools, and still, to a measure, the prevailing orthodoxy in which these schools function. Today, for example, we have in the world a prevailing orthodoxy. Whether it be a Christian orthodoxy or a Hindu orthodoxy is not important at the moment. We have the majority of the human beings of this world religiously integrated around certain simple, basic beliefs. These beliefs include certainly the reality of the existence of God, the immortality of the human soul, and the victory of good over evil. These beliefs are disseminated even throughout the so-called Soviet Union, and every effort of materialism in that area to overthrow these beliefs has notably failed. These beliefs exist in China, they exist in India, and in all parts of the world. Thus we have a tremendous body of belief in fundamental spiritual value. And yet, just as we had this tremendous body of believers in those days and in these times, we now find ourselves in the presence of the long shadow of a highly exaggerated Hermetic thinking. We have in that the rise of science. We have the gradual recognition that we live in a scientific universe. We have man exploring the exactitudes of space, depending completely upon such sciences as mathematics for the possible calculations by which he seeks to attain his ends. And mathematics, as Pythagoras pointed out, is the first science of God. Thus we have an excessive intellectualism which has not yet achieved the Hermetic position, namely that knowledge is suspended primarily from God as fact, the inevitable thing as it is, that God is total reality, and that this reality is the totality of all things known and unknown, and that no matter what we can ever know, we can never discover that which destroys the fact of reality. For all knowledge is the triumph of reality over superstition or ignorance. Thus, the infinite universe of realities, of facts, of scientific procedures, this universe is held within the tremendous principle of all fact, all reality, all procedure. And this principle is alive. This principle is a dynamic, not a static. And this principle permeates all other things with itself, so that everything that exists bears within it the stamp of reality. And man's search is the search for this reality in things, or in space, or in self. Now here we have, then, science rising, and even in our modern world, science is a minority group, very definitely a minority group. It lives in the same world with a dynamic religion, yet it is not reconciled with that religion. Yet its essential discoveries and principles are not irreconcilable with religion. They simply stand apart, much in the same way that Hermetic philosophy and the early rise of Christianity, these stood apart. They had more in common than they ever knew, but they were never able to cement this common understanding. They were never able to bridge across between faith and fact. They never could recognize faith as another name for a scientific procedure. They were never able to recognize that the ways of faith are as scientific as the ways of atomic research. Because of this same division between two systems of thought, we are producing a generation of human beings in whose natures there are strong, irreconcilable, or at least unreconciled, divisions. The person of today, growing up in his world, is in the presence of a constant pressure of conflicting conceptions and conflicting convictions. Going to school, he is confronted with them. And at the present time, our policy is, if this person is potentially the type of material that we hope will become an intellectual leader, is to pass him through 4 years of college. The purpose of this being primarily to destroy his idealistic convictions. We might just as well face it. That is what it amounts to. The purpose of it is to make him worship knowledge and never to reveal to him that knowledge is merely the manifestation of the knower, and that without the universal knower, there could be no universal knowledge to challenge him. So we have this conflict, which inherited from the past, from little minority squabble 19 centuries ago, could very well, and does very often, land the modern young person in the juvenile courts because of conflict. Therefore, we cannot say that this long problem should just be allowed to drift, nor should we overlook the examples and the wisdom and evidence of the past relating to these things. Now, as we go along in this, we find there are other minority groups. As distinguished from the popular mind, a structure very difficult to analyze at this time, because it doesn't seem to be very sure of what it is thinking, if at all. In distinction to the popular mind, we have what we term the intellectual. Now, the intellectual, or the mental type, the individual who is searching for knowledge, per se, He is not necessarily searching for mathematical formulas. He is searching for the power to know, and the end of knowing, of course, is the knowledge of good and evil. The knower, the intellectual, also presents a problem. We have had nearly 18 centuries of him in the post-Christian world under the general name of the intellectual leader, the philosopher, the scholar, the learned person, the professor. Everything from the school teacher to the Oxford Dome comes under this particular heading. He is also the teacher, because the teacher is one of whom it must be assumed that he knows at least more than those he teaches. This is sometimes an assumption, but at the same time, there are evidences to sustain that in most cases, there is a certain leadership possible. But now this problem of knowing has given us a variety of knowing beliefs. And we have today the great clash of the intellectual schools. We have the Kantians and the Hegelians. We have the defenders of Schopenhauer and the defenders of Nietzsche. We have the new philosophies of every kind, from the idealism of Bergson to the prevailing distemper of existentialism. We have these beliefs, beliefs of disillusionment, beliefs of despair, beliefs of frustration and of hope and of fear. We have beliefs of all kinds rising from or catering to the neurotic pressures of our time. So we have this mysterious thing of man who also seeks to know. He seeks to know ethically that which is good. He seeks to know to a degree idealistically that which is true for him. He would like to live well if the effort is not too great. He would like to know more than he knows, first because he thinks he could earn more that way. Sometimes he would like to know enough to be able to console himself about his own uncertainties. He wants to know. The great desire to know rises strongly in the mass mind of mankind. And here we have the conflict between knowing and not knowing. And we have the big problem of the moment. The problem that has been argued and debated for years. Namely, can we know? What can we know? Can we know anything that we will not have to unknow at some later time? Is all knowing relative? Is knowing merely the collecting of the traditional belief of our race? Is the physician a true knower after he graduates from medical school? Is the lawyer a true knower after he has read Roman law and British jurisprudence? What is knowing? Is it the individual familiarizing himself with the past, with other beliefs, with the statistical material available on the subjects that interest him? Is this knowing merely the handing on of report? And we have this very strongly in education. And Neoplatonism points out that the fallacy here is that all knowing must ascend. That the end of knowing is that man shall truly know the truth. And that the truth is something that is apart from particular knowledge. A man may discover something of truth by learning to play the piano. But if he does not add this concept to something else, he will become a musician, but he will not become a truth knower. That truth is something total, and that all education must in some way strive for this totality, but it does not know how. Thus, there has to be this truth that sets us free instead of this neo-truth that keeps us in bondage. The Neoplatonist answers very simply that the only solution to this problem is to recognize that man partakes in his own nature not only of the attributes of truth possibility, but the very substance of a living truth fact, that the truth resides in the innermost parts of the conscious life of man, and that the great journey of the individual is from ignorance to truth, and that truth is something supreme, something infinitely sacred, something absolutely divine, and that therefore the search for truth is essentially identical with the search for all realities with which the human being is concerned. The individual who attains to the state of truth has discovered why he should live well and how he can live well. There can therefore be no truth, as Plotinus points out, that does not produce a change away from error in the actual life of the person who attains it. A person can be educated and still unmoral. A person cannot possess truth or be possessed by truth and be unmoral. The individual can become learned and still be dishonest. But the one who attains truth cannot be dishonest. Therefore, truth is a transforming, living thing. And that which attains it can never function inconsistently with that which it has attained. On this grounds, all knowledge is at the moment inadequate, for we have no form of knowledge which compels us instinctively, inevitably, and irresistibly to right action. We know much and still have to struggle with our own conscience. We know exactly what we should do, but we haven't the courage to do it. The truths we so-called possess are not dynamic enough to give us the vitality for the fulfillment of themselves in conduct. This is the great burden of Neoplatonism, and it is certainly the burden of Confucianism. For Confucius said, the superior man is one who is incapable of an inferior action. It isn't one who doesn't perform it because he knows better. It is the one who is incapable of it, because the instinct which has given him this superiority moving from within himself is irresistible. It is moving from the same or deeper source, from as the cause of his previous difficulty came from. He is moved from within to compromise. When truth is his, he is moved from within not to compromise, and he will always follow inward motion. And the reason why he does not do well always at the present time is because inward motion does not impel him to do well. So truth now becomes, to Neoplatonism, the irresistible, redeeming, regenerating, civilizing power. And nothing can be said to be true that does not change people for the better. It may be a fact that the tides are affected by the moon. It may be a fact that there are certain formulas by which atoms can be split. It may be a fact that they have been split. But unless the discovery of how to split atoms carries with it such a tremendous spiritual experience that the person who splits the atom can never, from any motive or reason, permit that knowledge to be used for anything but good. Unless that is there, there is no truth, regardless of the fact. Truth must be the power that makes us do things well and do that which is good. For the end of truth is to know that which is good, and therefore to possess both the knowledge and the dynamic to perform that which we know. This is the danger pointed out by Neoplatonism in relationship to education. And their cry, their problem, their premise is just as sound today as it was then. And because they were a minority sect and at that time were neglected, Those who say the same things today are a minority sect and will be neglected. But that which is said is nevertheless true. And whether it is accepted or rejected, as Neoplatonism points out, truth is unmoved, like the old American Indian proverb that is said to have been inscribed around the walls of the study of King George V of England. The moon is not frightened by the baying of wolves. That which is does not change, regardless of whether it is accepted or not accepted. Thus, Neoplatonism has its offering of today, man searching for the dynamic of truth. And if he searched for the dynamic of truth as industriously and as patiently as he has sought other things, for instance, his knowledge of atomics, he would today not only have a great science, but a great morality to control it, which he does not have. Now, what is the contribution of Gnosticism to this little pattern? Here is the third group. This group working on an essentially religious level. The purpose of Gnosticism is the direct search for good. And in this search for good, we come to another problem that confronts the modern world. And that is that with the Gnostics, and certainly with the attitude that they took, we have a large proposition confronting us to find out what is meant by good. The Gnosis says, until we know what is good, we can never do that which is right. What is good? What is this tremendous power of things at the root of existence? What is this power that Aquinas also debates in his double question as to whether a thing is good because God wills it or whether God wills it because it is good? What comes first, the good or the God? Is God good or is good God? And if God is not primary and must obey the law of good, then what is the law that God obeys? Or if God is primary and his will is good, then what is the good which he wills? These have been debated from the dawn of religious thinking. But the great problem that Gnosticism pointed out is this great need, this tremendous need, to integrate a common understanding of what is good. Now, they were perfectly aware, even in Alexandria, that we have to approach good on two levels, relative good and absolute good. Relative good we see around us every day. It is a common spectacle, a good which is locked within the dimensions of time, a good which cannot escape from the currency of things, a good which is refutable 100 years from now and was not applicable 100 years ago. There is a good which is also an immediate good, the imminent as opposed to the eminent. There is a good which is so difficult that at the moment it appears evil. There is also this unending concept that the imperfect mind of man cannot achieve to a perfect statement of good or a perfect definition of good. What we call good is that which is agreeable or likable. What we call bad is that which is disagreeable or unlikable. That which injures another may be good for us. That which injures us may be good for another. All these problems evolve around the effort of man to find the final central orientation of himself. Psychology is approaching this problem as basically as it can, but is also in a little dilemma for the reason that the psychologist cannot decide which of themselves is good. They cannot decide which of their own systems certainly is best. They have therefore as yet no reconciled concept, no over concept. Now, good can be achieved on a relative basis by a court of law, which will come to justice as far as it can do so in the light of the evidence. And the good judge is the one who, weighing the evidence, gives the most honorable interpretation that he can. But that his interpretation is right, or that the evidence is true, he can never know. Thus, the Gnostic situation was the discovery of the nature of ultimate good. How is it to be done? And because Gnosticism was essentially a mystical tradition, it came to a very simple concept, namely that good cannot be known as a process of the mind. Good can only be experienced as the result of revelation. That good can only be bestowed upon man. That the experience of good is the experience of God in the life of that man. Now, we can also say, of course, that this experience of God may be misinterpreted, that what one man calls an experience of God may not seem so to another. And in the name of the experience of God, some very terrible things have been done to the world. And in a great many instances, terrible doctrines and horrible edicts have been passed, undoubtedly, with the deepest sincerity and the full contrition of spirit. What then is to guide us in the knowing of internal good? And of course, Gnosticism points out that this is the entire concept behind the theory or the philosophy of various purgations of consciousness, or cathartic philosophy, producing a catharsis or cleansing of the individual. Only the individual in whose personal nature corruption has ceased can have the mystical experience of good. If any other person has such a kind of experience, he will distort it and deform it and profane it by the very process of it passing through his consciousness. If he is intolerant, the good will become merely distorted into an instrument for the advancement of his intolerance. Therefore, the individual who has his own purposes can never experience good per se. The only person who can experience good is one who has completely renounced self-interest and has completely renounced the human equation as an influence or part of his life. Thus, the demand for the ascetic life, the renunciation of worldliness, the individual achieving a state in which nothing can be important but the revelation of the divine will. Now, the fact that the ascetic goes out and gives up the world does not prove that he is an ascetic. He may also be a neurotic and do the same thing. It does not prove that by any action of his outward person, no matter how consecrated that action may appear, that that action is without ulterior motive. Thus, in the Gnosis, the point was very clearly made that only through years of testing and of trying, only through the most diligent application of principles, the most total and complete analysis of self, and the final renunciation and rejection of everything that is ulterior within the self, can the individual come to the point in which he may depend upon the purity of revelation. But revelation, again, is a relative thing. And revelation, or the experiencing of the good, can come to many kinds of persons. We will not say necessarily that it is complete, any more than Gnosticism affirms that it is complete. But it can be an extension of our present realization of good. Now, the proof that it is a revelation and not an hallucination arises also from the consequences of it. At the moment, there may be no way of testing And here we come upon a point which has been made much of since Gnosticism and also in psychology, but it is essentially a point in Gnosis. And that point relates to the individual who receives a revelation of some kind. Instinctively, he falls under mechanisms. One of these mechanisms is his desperate fear to apply what he has experienced. The strange, mysterious sensing that if he applies it, he may lose it. This is only an extension of his own doubt about himself. He is perhaps inwardly aware that by nature, constitution, and attainments, that it is unreasonable or unlikely that truth could come to him. As long as he does not apply his revelation, he can always cling to it and hold it to be true. But if he applies it objectively and observes that it does not function correctly, if by application it disproves itself, then this individual is deprived of the support of a spiritual conviction within himself. So he is inclined to be careful not to apply. Yet in Gnosis, the first problem emphasized is application. The truth is revealed, it must then be applied. And if it is true, it will operate. And it will operate constructively. And it will produce nothing different from itself under any condition. If it is true, it will increase truth. If it is untrue, it will increase error. The individual, therefore, whose truth does not produce some kind of good, has no truth. In this thinking, the search for good is therefore, in a sense, the search for harmlessness. It is the search for value, which again produces within the individual a condition of integration or homogeneity of effort. And as the Gnostic Valentinus points out, the true experience of the good is most quickly tested by the fact that it produces the harmless person who is at the same time certain of his own conduct. The individual who by instinct cannot perform an action contrary to good. Revelation flowing out through the person is evidenced by a greater measure of good. And in our level of thinking, there are good things which we hope for. They may not be ultimate, but they cannot be deficient in any state superior to themselves. Therefore, we can say that kindness is not an ultimate good, that there may be good beyond it. But if that kindness is real, that ultimate good cannot be unkind, because it must not be deficient in any of the lesser forms of itself. Therefore, a kind of attitude of good which leads to cruelty of conduct cannot be good. A revelation which leads to intolerance cannot be true, because here is an assumed greater good in violation with a common good which experience has justified. Now, we can say that absolute truth might violate everything less than itself. It will not violate anything of its own nature. It can only violate that which is contrary to its own nature. A greater sense or knowing of good may elevate our discrimination about all things. But good cannot make a person destructive. And anything which can is not good. And all excuse to the contrary is not valid. Because destructiveness, as Gnosticism points out, is a causation which sets in motion a sequence of further destructiveness. And that all of this destructiveness must ultimately be washed out by ultimate good. That therefore this destructiveness forms the adversary which opposes good. In our daily thinking, which must be on the moderate level, we also, all of us, have some intuitive conscience sense of good. And this good has been, for the most part, sustained whenever we have been able to practice it. Consequently, revelation must strengthen this good toward achievement of greater goodness. Revelation can never result in a quality which detracts from good. Nor is it at all a matter of excuse or explanation. There is no way of explaining away facts. That which causes injury causes factual injury, and no rational integration or rational interpretation can justify the act of destruction. Therefore, in Gnosticism, the purpose always is to measure the achievement of the gnosis in the terms of the unfolding harmlessness of man. Now, wherever we have had religious intolerance or harmfulness caused by sincerity, we have nearly always found that it is associated with too limited a perspective towards values. Wherever the effort to be true and to be right has led to trouble, it is because the troublemaker was devout but not intelligent. Therefore, good must also indicate or prove the presence of increasing ability to administer the power of God. The individual who achieves a spiritual value receives with his inner understanding a sense of use. It is not possible for an individual to say, for instance, as people have come to me and said, "I've just been illuminated, what did it mean?" You can't have such a situation. Inasmuch as an extension of consciousness is an extension of meaning and cannot exist apart from it. And any extension, apparently, of strange phenomenal circumstances not accompanied by an appropriate extension of understanding must be regarded as delusional of some kind. The individual cannot grow inwardly without improving his total nature. Though the Gnostic pointed out that the search for good becomes the supreme career of the truly devout person, for in his effort to serve God, his only protection is his own enlightened understanding. It is the only way in which he can preserve the honor of deity. For if in a benighted, fanatical manner he even tries to serve God, he will disgrace that which he serves. So all service involves man's growing ability to comprehend the good and to act according to the comprehension of the good which he possesses, thus opening the way for the increase of this factor within his own experience consciousness. Now here we have these patterns then adding up to the problems of our time coming down to us as directive. For instance, concerned with such a question as, where will we all be as a civilization, as a people, 100 years from now? Not necessarily ourselves, we may not be present, but our world collectively thinking. Where will this world be if we lack directives, if we continue to have no more internal resource than we have today? What will our external achievements do to us? And that was the question that the Gnostics were asking, and the Neoplatonists, and the Hermetists 2,000 years ago, or nearly so. What are these directions without directive? They simply mean drifting along lines of opportunism, or retrenching against immediate disaster, without plan, purpose, program, or any design suitable to to achieve lasting results. Now, as our primary purpose in this series is not only to compare these teachings, but to point out primarily the Hermetic position in preparation for a study of the actual Hermetic literature itself, I think we must come back now to their premise, the scientific premise, in which they reached out and actually enclosed a large part of both Gnosticism and Neoplatonism. At least the masters of the Hermetic schools intertwined their teachings with those of these other schools and also with the system of Christianity. Christianity perhaps played a less important part in their thinking than the other schools for the simple reason that Christianity was an obvious thing. When you say to someone, do good to others, or be honest, or be kind, or be brotherly, you do not challenge the scientist, nor do you challenge the philosopher. If he is a person of values, he admits that this is true, regardless of what the logic behind it may be. He might be able to spend 10 years and develop the scientific explanation, but it would still only support something so obvious and so undeniable that there would be love's labor lost. There would be nothing gained by such an endeavor. Therefore, these schools sought to work with problems not quite so obvious, but which must ultimately arise in the course of growth, because in the course of growth, everything that is concealed must be revealed. And growth is the unfolding into the obvious of things not obvious. So the Hermetic school was seeking to create foundations upon which newer generations could build structures of knowing by means of which the total program of human society could be advanced. They did not intend that these programs of knowing would ever interfere with a Sermon on the Mount or any of these essential convictions of Christian mysticism. They were simply seeking for more exact instruments of knowing in specialized fields of endeavor. Now, as we go into the alchemical phase of this, which began probably in the 6th or 7th century and continued on down to the rise of modern chemistry, Hermetic philosophy was distinguished from the beginning by its byproducts. In addition to its principal theme, it inspired innumerable investigations. It inspired the alchemist to make all kinds of experiments in his retorts and in his laboratories. And I have seen lists of practical products that we use today that is very impressive, a very long list, hundreds of items, every one of which represented a disappointment to some alchemist. He was searching for the elixir of life or the mystery of the transmutation of metals, and he came up instead with a new formula for soap. It didn't quite work out as he intended, but he did make a valuable contribution. They locked one alchemist in a basement and fed him through a hole in the door of his cell until he was able to make gold. He never managed to make gold, but he discovered the formula for Dresden china. All kinds of things have been found by those looking for something else. And Hermetic philosophy has therefore indirectly contributed a great deal, practically all, of the basic knowledge of chemistry that we possess, and hundreds of byproducts arising in early chemical research. However, the alchemist was more than this. He was searching for the one thing which must ultimately come. And he was, like most of us, sometimes sidetracked by his byproducts. He was never completely willing to stop trying, however. And even though some of his byproducts made him richer than the gold he might have fashioned, he still was searching for this other thing. He was searching for the master key to the total transformation of matter. He was convinced that what we call matter is in reality spirit in disguise. He knew from his own experiences that everything that is not spiritual is a kind of spirit, limited, blocked, or impeded in some way. Therefore, every error is some kind of a truth that we have not yet mastered. Every delusion is a fact out of focus. Every failure tells us something about a success that lies within nearer grasp because of the reverse we have passed through. Thus man, with all his humanity, and it is a broad statement covering a wide variety of attributes, man in his total humanity is God itself, with its divinity locked within this strange casement of base metals. And the effort to find the science for the release of this divine factor, the science for the release of reality, of fact, of the total hermetic mystery, was his challenge, and it has always been his challenge. His challenge was not to conquer nature, but to release nature. As one of the great alchemists, Basilus Valentinus, said, the end of alchemy is man becoming the voluntary servant of nature. That nature must be obeyed, and that wisdom is not the ravishing and ravaging of nature. The wisdom is man achieving a subtle, sensitive, spiritual rapport with nature, in which man can cause nature to open her wonders, reveal them without fear to the being who is without fault. This is almost exactly the wording of Valentinus. And it is the idea, the concept of man persuading, man inducing the universe to give up its secret. And this secret to be won only by man's love and not by man's strength. Won by the wisdom principle, by the principle of obedience, the acceptance of the challenge and the acceptance of the responsibility, both together. So in the Hermetic philosophy, we have this pattern outlined. Gradually unfolding through the Hermetic books, which conceal it under allegory and legend. But what the Hermetic philosopher was seeking for was this wonderful, mysterious powder of transmutation, the Red Lion, the mysterious power which changes all things instantly. And that mysterious power was, to his way of operating, some way locked up in the mystery of universal or divine mind. That this mind had some way within it the power of the spontaneous release of itself. That mind, as the bridge between nature and God, can be crossed. And that this mind can, in some mysterious way, open a blazing core of facts by means of which the individual becomes master of the world. Not because he becomes its ruler, not because he becomes richer than someone else, not because others honor him, but simply because he has achieved mastery over illusion. That he stands in the full awareness of the glory of the creating power, that he accepts totally the highest of all scientific facts, and that is this fact of the eternal presence of this gold, this mysterious substance locked in everything. The alchemist says, and I remember the work by Weidenfeld, The Secret of the Adepts, in which it is stated that the alchemist does not manufacture gold. He does not create gold. He discovers it. He finds it where it is. He causes it to grow. He feeds it the nutrition that is necessary for its survival. And when he has brought it forth into birth, then this gold will transmute a world of base metals, 100,000 times its own weight, into the purest gold. This is the great golden key of science. Science which can transmute and transform all need, all inability, all lack into an abundance, by drawing upon the universal principle of truth, or gold, that is locked in everything. And man, having discovered the perfect science of sciences, can then transform or transmute 100,000 times the weight of truth in ignorance, and transform it immediately into pure gold. For wherever this touches, it is like the fabled king of Crete. Everything it touches is turned to gold. Thus, everything that the true science key touches or unlocks is turned into truth, turned into reality, turned into a useful and necessary aid to the advancement of the total state of the universe, and along with it, the immediate state of man. So the search for the science of sciences, the science which transforms that which is not spirit into spirit again, or releases spirit, causing it to grow in all things, including in man himself, until it becomes the master of the world. All of these speculations were concealed in terms strange and obscure, but changed into modern language and into modern thinking, there is not one of these speculations that does not have a contemporary application. It points out to us the things we must do now, the things that need the doing, and reminds us as we gather here that as in Alexandria, there will only be a few who will know what is needed or will be impelled to meet that need. But out of each generation, there must be some who will carry on this mysterious golden thread until in the fullness of time, the restoration of essential learning can be achieved. Because the answer was there in the beginning, and until men accept the answer, the problems can never be solved. And in these answers that we have suggested, I think we lay a sufficient foundation to go on later with the next step of our hermetic researches. And thank you very much.